Okay, good morning, everybody. The last 2 weeks we had a discussion about the Beis HaMikdash, about the Kotel. For those who were at the wedding last night, I just got home. So so let's just continue a little bit on that theme. We mentioned briefly last week the opinion of the Rambam, that the Rambam says that Kila Shaita V'Kitchili Asalava, which means when the Makam HaMikdash was infused with its level of, with its status of sanctity, with its Kedusha, so we assume that that's something that did not wane after the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. We assume that that's something that continued on, and even nowadays when we have no longer a Beis HaMikdash, we still assume that there is a Kedusha in the Makam HaMikdash. That's what the Rambam told us. And the Rambam says the reason why this is in fact the case is because what endowed the Makam HaMikdash with Kedusha is the fact that the Shechina rested there. The Rambam says, Shechina ain't a betela liolam. You can never get rid of the Shechina, and therefore we assume that the Makam HaMikdash retains its status of Kedusha. This is what the Gemara says in Brachos, Daf Samach Beis, Amud Beis, V'haya einai v'libi sham kalayam. God, so to speak, says, my heart and my eyes will always be there, kalayam, and will always be in the Makam HaMikdash, which seems to indicate that there will always be a presence of the Shechina. We mentioned briefly as well that there are those who point out, if the Shechina is Eina B'Tela, if we assume that the Shechina, that God's presence is always resting in the Makam HaMikdash, then what do we mean when we daven every day and we say, V'sechazena Einenu B'Shuvcha L'Tzion B'Rachamim? What are we asking for? We look forward to the day when God will restore His presence to the Beis HaMikdash, to the Makam HaMikdash. What do you mean? So we have a separate bracha where we ask for the Beis HaMikdash. But what is it that we ask? That the Shechina, Hamachazir Shechinasa L'Tzion, but the Shechina is there, Eina B'Tela L'Yolam. So what does that mean? So the Arachayim HaKadosh as well as the Binyan Tzion point out that what it means is that there are different degrees, there are different variations of how much, how intense the presence of the Shechina could actually be. The Gemara tells us if you have a minion of people learning together, the Shechina is there. If you have three people sitting together and learning, the Shechina is there. Two people sitting together and learning, Shechina is there. One person sitting by themselves and learning, also the Shechina is there. So what does it mean? If the Shechina is there with one, why do you need to tell me the whole list? The answer is, well, it depends how much degree of Shechina is going to be there. So again, if you have 10 people learning together, then the degree of Shechina is going to be very potent and very obvious. If you have only one person learning by himself, obviously the Shechina is going to be there, but it won't be the same presence of Shechina as would have been there if there were more people. So this is what it means with Sechazena Einenu. Of course, there is the retention of Kedusha in the Makam HaMikdash, because we assume Shechina Eina B'Tela Liyolam, we can never get rid of the presence of the Shechina. However, the intensity of the presence of the Shechina is not the same as it will be, and that which we look forward to when we have a Beis HaMikdash again. Based on the fact that the Rambam is the accepted opinion, the Magen Avraham writes this in Hilchos Tisha B'Av, Siman Tov Kuf Samach Aleph, Mishneh Berurah writes it there as well, that we assume, like the Rambam, that the Makam HaMikdash retains its status of Kedusha even La'achar HaChurban, even after the Churban Beis HaMikdash. And because of that, the assumption is that we have an obligation of Mora Migdash even nowadays as well. Let's look at the Gemara in Yevamos, Vav Amud Beis. Says the Gemara as follows, which is the first entry on the source sheet. We have a mitzvah, U'migdashi tira'u. You have to have fear, you have to have awe from the Makam HaMikdash. Now what exactly does it mean to have awe, to have fear from the Makam HaMikdash? A person should walk in trembling? No, that's not what it means. We'll see in a few minutes what exactly it means. What is our obligation? Says the Gemara in Yevamos. Now you have to back up over here. Why is the Gemara assuming there's a connection between Shabbos and the Beis HaMikdash? Where does that come from? Anybody? The Pasuk says, Eshav sosai tishmoru, umikdashi tirau ani Hashem. So what's the connection? You have to keep my Shabbos and fear the Beis HaMikdash. Ani Hashem, I am your God. What's the connection between keeping Shabbos and fearing the Beis HaMikdash? So the Gemara is bothered by this. So really, the Gemara interprets it to mean that, yes, it's true, we have an obligation to build a Beis HaMikdash, but a Shabbos HaTishmoru. Don't you dare build that Beis HaMikdash on Shabbos and violate one of the Hilchos Shabbos. That's really what the Pasuk means. The Gemara now goes and gives an added level of meaning to the Pasuk, and it says as follows. There's another connection between Shabbos and the Beis HaMikdash. And what is that? Mashmira ha'amura b'Shabbos li'olam. Just like we assume, we don't say that Shabbos only has to be observed when we have a Beis HaMikdash. Shabbos is something which is for all posterity, for all generations. And even at a time when we don't recognize the presence of the Shechina, even at a time where we don't have a Beis HaMikdash, we have to keep Shabbos. So too, af mora ha'amura b'migdash li'olam, says the Gemara. So too, just like Shabbos, the reason why Shabbos and Beis HaMikdash are put in the same pasuk as Shabbos, so say tishmaru mikdashi tirau, is because The same way Shabbos is relevant for all generations, so too the Mora Migdash, that which we have to have respect for the Makam HaMigdash, is relevant for all generations, meaning, even at a time, when we don't have a Beis HaMigdash, we assume that there's a mitzvah to have Mora Migdash as well. This is what the Rambam paskins, not surprisingly. Again, the Rambam is the one who's of the opinion that the Makam HaMigdash retains its Kedusha, so that follows that the Rambam also tells us that the mitzvah of Mora Migdash applies even today. Now, the Ravid disagrees. The Ravid is the commentary who very often disagrees on the Rambam, and he's printed on the page of the Rambam, and very often he's very sharp against the Rambam. He's very upset about how the Rambam formulated some of the halachos. So the Ravid here says it's not true. The Ravid says nowadays when we have no Beis HaMikdash, there is no Kedusha there anymore. Nowadays, says the Ravid, since there's no Kedusha, there is also no obligation of Mora Migdash anymore. This is what the Ravid says. And I forgot to put it on, but the Ravid writes as follows. The fee. Shahi Yodea Ezra Shahamigdash Vyushalayim Asidim Lihishtanos Uliskadish Kiddush Acher Olami Bechavad Hashem Liolam, says the Ravid. Ezra knew when he built the second Beis HaMikdash that it was not going to last forever. Ezra knew that there was going to come a time when it would be destroyed and there would be a third Beis HaMikdash and they would change things around and they would build a new edifice and it would look different than his. And therefore he never endowed the place with a Kedusha Olamis because he said later on something is going to come and take over everything which I have created. The Ravid ends off and he says, Kach nigla li misod Hashem li reyav. I had a revelation that told me that this is the case, and that's why I feel that I have the right to argue with the Rambam on this very point, because I had a revelation that told me that this is what happened when the second Beis HaMikdash was built, and therefore we do not have a Kedusha to the Makam HaMikdash any longer. So this is a very famous disagreement. Again, like we mentioned, this is the opinion of the Rambam, this is what's been the accepted opinion, that we assume there's a Kedusha to the Makam HaMikdash, even Mizman HaZeh. Based on that, Rav Nevensel, who was the Rav of the Ira Atika, he's still alive, but he was the Chavrusa of Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach for many years, the Talmud Muvak of Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, so he pointed out that nowadays when we're blessed that we have sovereignty over the Makam HaMikdash, and therefore we have to have our own police force walking around and manning the Makam HaMikdash, says the Rav Nevensel, that's very nice, but we have to be very careful to do our best that we follow the rules of Mora Migdash, even while we are having Anshei Bitachon on the Harabayis, even when we're having people who have to guard the Makam HaMikdash, but it has to be done in the proper context. And therefore he says, I mean, for most of us, I imagine, we're not in the police force, and we're not really, this is not such a relevant question, but he discussed it at length with those who it's relevant to, and he said, well, you should try your best to go to the mikvah before you have a shift there. You should try your best that after your shift is over, you shouldn't just be hanging around and talking to your friends. You should try your best that, you know, you don't play around when you're in the Makam HaMikdash. This is a serious place. And we assume that even nowadays, this is considered something which has its status of Kedusha. How can that be? Why should we assume that there's a Kedusha even without a Beis HaMikdash? We're missing the whole boat. We're missing everything. How can you say that there's a place that just has sanctity just for the sake of having sanctity? What does it mean? So the Brisker Rav points out, interestingly enough, that by Yaakov Avinu we find many, many generations before there was a Beis HaMikdash. Yaakov Avinu is before the whole story ever started. So the Brisker Rav points out, what do we find? Yaakov Avinu goes to sleep. And as we know, the Medrash tells us he goes to sleep where? What would eventually become the Makam HaMikdash. At the time, Yaakov had no idea. And he wakes up and he says, Yesh Hashem HaMakam HaZeh, Anochi Lo Yadati. I never knew, I never would have gone to sleep here had I known this was the Beis HaMikdash. Never would have done such a thing, it's a disgrace. So Yaakov Avinu says, Vayira Vayomar. Yaakov Avinu wakes up and he's afraid and he says, Manora HaMakam HaZeh. Ein zeki im beis elokim v'zeh shar hashamayim. Now, what exactly does that mean? Ein zeki im beis elokim. What do you mean? There's no beis hamikdash here. At the time that Yaakov Avinu went to sleep, what kedusha did the makam hamikdash have? What was there? Nothing. Nobody ever offered karbanos there. Akedas Yitzchak took place there. Okay, very nice. But why does that give it a status of kedusha? It gives it a very sentimental value to the family, perhaps to the Jewish people. But why should we assume that this should have any level of Kedusha? Says the Brisker Rav, what you see from the story of Yaakov Avinu is that even before there was a Beis HaMikdash, there was already a special level of Kedusha that was endowed into that place. The Shekhinah, we assume, rested there more so than in other places, and that's why Yaakov Avinu was taken aback that he had the gall to fall asleep there, and therefore he says the Brisker Rav, this is why we can understand also in the other direction, even after the Beis HaMikdash is destroyed, also, it can retain a status of Kedusha the same way it had a status of Kedusha even before the Beis HaMikdash was built as well. So this is with regard to that. Now, perhaps an extension of the Din Mora Migdash, the Achronim say, perhaps it extends also to a Beis HaKnesses. And what we're going to discuss for the next 45 minutes, 40 minutes or so, is what exactly is, yes, that was already 15 minutes, what exactly is the similarity or the difference between the obligation that we have of Kedushas Beis HaKnesses and the obligation of Mora Beis HaMikdash. Now you'll say, why is it so relevant? We'll see in a couple of minutes why it's extremely relevant. So there are those who are of the opinion that some Rishonim say, the Ran and others say, well, the Beis HaKnesses is a very nice second fiddle. It's not really a Beis HaMikdash, as we know. And therefore, a Beis HaKnesses really does not have, on a biblical level, it really does not have any status of Kedusha. I find that very shocking. So the Chachamim came along and said, well, you know, it's not really right. You have an Aron Kodesh here, you have a Beis HaKnesses, everyone comes to daven every day, and we have Shiurim and whatever. How can you say that we're just going to defile this room? It doesn't make any sense. So the Ran says that the Chacham came along and instituted an obligation of having covered Beis HaKnesses as well. It's very striking. How can you say such a thing? On a level of Daraisa, we wouldn't have an obligation to have respect for the Beis HaKnesses? Sounds very surprising. The Yireim, another one of the Rishonim, disagrees with the Ran, and he writes as follows. Let's read this together because it's a very important point that he makes. He says, Mora Migdash, this obligation that we have of Mora Beis HaMigdash, of fearing the Makam HaMigdash, Siva, Behikanes Adam LeMigdash, that is not only an obligation when a person enters the Makam HaMigdash, or the Beis HaMigdash itself, he says, also the Beis HaKnesses, O Le Beis HaMedrash. So he extends the concept of Mora Migdash to be not only in the Beis HaMigdash proper, but also in a Beis HaKnesses and a Beis HaMedrash. As we read in Parshas Behar, it doesn't mean you should walk into the Beis HaMikdash and be in awe of everything that you see, but rather, it means you should have fear for the person who told you to build the Beis HaMikdash, which is obviously the Ribbono Shel Olam himself. Pirush, what it means is, min ha-borei baruch hu, o-matzino Beis HaKnesses u-Beis HaMedrash, Shenikru Migdash. And in fact, we find, he says, that a Beis HaKnesses and a Beis HaMedrash are given that title of Migdash, of a Makam HaMigdash as well. D'tanya b'teres Kohanim, Vashimozi es Migdashechem l'rabos bate knesias bate midrashos. And then, he goes on to say that, as we know, we have a Beis HaMigdash, and then we have what we call a Migdash Ma'at, a shul is called, a miniature Beis HaMigdash. It's not just a funny, cute way of calling a shul. No, it means that the same way the Shechina rested in the Makam HaMigdash proper in the Beis HaMigdash, we assume that it's a Migdash Ma'at, obviously not to the same degree, but we have a Migdash Ma'at where the Shekhinah rests its presence here as well, and therefore, says the Yireim, that's why we have the same obligation of Mora Migdash that applies in the Beis HaMigdash, would apply to a Beis HaKnesses as well. Now, based on this idea that we assume a Beis HaKnesses also has a status of a miniature Beis HaMigdash, there are some very important halachas that come out of that. Number one, the Shari Tshuva says, you know, for those of us who daven in the morning, you don't have to say if you do or you don't. But for those of us who daven in the morning, there's many of us are in a rush. So the problem is, what is the priorities for the davening in the morning? What am I going to say? What am I going to leave out? Certainly, if you have somebody who's running out to work, obviously not the people here, if you have somebody who's running out to work and really doesn't have time in the morning, and you have to figure out how much am I going to say and what am I going to leave out? So again, if you're just running to the gym and you're figuring out what you're going to leave out, that's not a really good excuse. You should be waking up 10 minutes earlier and just say everything. If you have a really tight schedule because your children are, you know, have to get up to school or whatever it is, that's a great excuse. But if just for no other reason you're just deciding that you're going to cut and slice the davening here and there, not such a great idea. Where do we draw the line of priorities of what we should cut and what we should not? So this is a very important question, and it's not easy to answer all the time because sometimes we have more time than others. One of the things that's very often overlooked is karbanos. And karbanos is often overlooked because people think, I don't really have to say that. Rabbeinu Yonah writes in Maseches Brachos in the first parak that he believes that reciting karbanos nowadays might even be a fulfillment of a mitzvah midaraisa. Okay? I would imagine most people don't think about that. But reciting karbanos every day perhaps might be a fulfillment of a mitzvah midaraisa. So it's something which, in my opinion, I think, should be given great priority to. Now, it doesn't mean, you know, it's 10 pages in the front of the siddur. You don't have to say everything. But for those who are interested, if you want to get a siddur, I can show you exactly afterward. The Parshas HaTamid is Vayidaber Hashem al Moshe Lamer. We can look at it later. And Ha'ola, you say one little paragraph, which is about the Parshas HaTamid. That's about the daily offering that we would give in the Beis HaMikdash every day. Now, something we're supposed to do, we're supposed to say Karbanos if we have time, and it's something Rabbeinu Yonah says is very important. It might even be a mitzvah midaraisa to recite that every day. However, The Shari Tshuva points out it's better to say it in the Beis HaKnesses than to say it in Shul. You know, sometimes I'm running to Shul, so I'll start davening on the way. Assuming happens to a lot of people. So you start davening on the way because you don't want to be behind. Says Rabbeinu Yonah, says the Shari Tshuva, you can start davening on the way, but Karbanos should be reserved for the Shul. Why? Because Karbanos, what are we trying to do? We're trying to reenact the experience of offering the Karbanos. Obviously, we can't physically offer them, but at least we're going to say the words about offering the Karbanos, and that should be in some way in the place of offering the Karbanos proper in the physical way. Says Rabbeinu Yonah, don't you want to offer that in the Beis HaMikdash itself? Says the Shari Tshuva, you should really save that for Shul. Why? Because when you're walking on peninsula, that's not really a Beis HaMikdash. So if you really want to have the full experience of offering Karbanos in the Beis HaMikdash, you should really recite the Karbanos in Shul and not at home. Fascinating. Fascinating that that's how far he takes it. That's what the Shari Tshuva says. Similarly, the Mordechai writes in Maseches Megillah, we have a prohibition, Lo Sasun Kein LaShem Elokeichem, which means, that's quoted in Sefer Devarim, where we're told when you enter into Eretz Yisrael, you have to destroy Es Matzei Bosam, Tisha Beirin, you have to destroy all of the Avodah Zarah, you have to make sure to eradicate, to clean out the land from any idol worship that you might find anywhere. V'lo Sasun Kein LaShem Elokeichem, don't you dare think of doing such a thing to God Himself, meaning, you're not allowed to be so ser Beis HaMikdash. You're not allowed to take apart anything from the Beis HaMikdash itself. Based on that, the Ramah says, not only do we have a prohibition to take apart something which is a part of the Beis HaMikdash, but also, says the Ramah, we have a prohibition, Simen Kuf Nun Beis, Hilchos Beis HaKnesses, the Ramah says, one is not allowed to take apart any part of a Beis HaKnesses either. Because that would also be a violation of Lo Sasun Kein LaShem Elokeichem. You have to destroy the Avodah Zarah, but one is not allowed to destroy any part of a shul. Now, obviously, if you're knocking down a shul in order to build a bigger one, a nicer one, a fancier one, it's a different story. But if a person just, for no good reason, wants to destroy something, don't think that you're just violating the property of the shul. And, you know, when you write on a, we have little kids who come to shul and you write on a table with a crayon, with a marker, with a something, and you're destroying the shul's property. It's not just that you're a ganav and you're destroying the shul's property, but you're also perhaps violating Lo Sasun Kein LaShem Elokeichem, something to keep in mind. I remember when I was in elementary school, we used to daven in a shul, and kids, you know, they always gave us money to give out to tzedakah, our parents. So the kids, while they were waiting for the person to come around, they would scratch with the tzedakah, they would scratch the benches and do different things. And you say, well, it's not really a big deal. Well, it is a big deal. First of all, we shouldn't be doing that as children. But second of all, Lo Sasun Kein LaShem Elokeichem, you're destroying the property of God. That's the same as destroying a Beis HaMikdash. There was a whole shaila that came up, where Moshe Feinstein writes about it, about those who decided after the Kotel was, I guess, put back into service. So Rav Moshe Feinstein was asked the following question, that there were people who were so enamored by the experience of going to the Kotel, and they wanted to have some zikaron, some memory for themselves that they went. So they wanted to take a stone home from the Kotel and bring it, leave it onto their pillow, put it in their house, whatever it might be. And Rav Moshe disagrees so vehemently. He said, how can he do such a thing? First of all, he said, you have so many millions of people who come every year to visit the Kotel. If everyone takes one stone, we're not going to have a wall left. I don't know, not convinced. I think those stones are a little too big to take away. But even leaving that aside, said Rav Moshe, perhaps this might be a violation of Lo Sasun Kein LaShem Elokeichem. If you have something that belongs to the property of God, what right do you have to take it away and now defile it and put it in your own house, and now it has to watch the TV that you're watching, and now it has to have the experience that you're having? It's not really right, said Rav Moshe. And therefore, this is something which we take very seriously. But again, it's a connection that's made based on the fact that we assume that a Beis HaKnesses has the very same status in some way as a Beis HaMikdash itself. In the same way we have a prohibition of Lo Sasun Kein LaShem Elokeichem to the Beis HaMikdash proper, we also have that prohibition of Lo Sasun Kein LaShem Elokeichem in a Beis HaKnesses as well. There is a very fascinating discussion, which I guess is pretty relevant now that it's freezing outside. You know, I was in Toronto yesterday, it was really freezing, so yesterday I felt very warm, even though I was waiting for my car for an hour. I felt very warm. But there is an interesting discussion about, and you'll be surprised by this because we're so not used to thinking like this, but the Stechemet quotes the Stechemet is an encyclopedia who collected information from everywhere. Rabbi Chizkiyo Chaim Medini, he wrote an encyclopedia even though there was no computers at that time. It's amazing. So he wrote at the time that there was a big, big discussion about whether or not you are allowed to have a heating system in a shul. Now, thank God we paskin you're allowed to. But the question is, why should there even be a shaila? Why wouldn't I be able to have a heating system in a shul? What's wrong with that? Well, he suggests the following. Rav Meir Shapiro, once when he became the Rav of Pietrakov, which I'm not sure exactly where that is, but somewhere in Europe. Anybody know? What? It's in Poland? So when he became the Rav, when Rav Meir Shapir became the Rav there, so there was a very big shul, and obviously it was freezing in the winter in Poland, and they came to him and they asked him, are we allowed to have, you know, logs with wood, or are we allowed to have a heating system installed into the shul? And he wasn't sure, and people said, what do you mean you're not sure? It's freezing outside. What's, you know, what are we going to do? So he said, I can bring a proof that I think you're not allowed to. Because the Gemara says, fascinating story, the Gemara says that once in a while they have to do Iber Hashanah, which means if the seasons got a little messed up, if everything got a little bit off kilter, so then we assume you have to figure out how to push it back. How are we going to have the solar and the lunar calendar running in the same kind of cycle, even though it's a couple of days off every year, 365 and 354, so we have to somehow make it up. So every once in a while they used to make an Iber Hashanah, for whatever reason. So the Gemara says they had a committee that got together, and they would decide whether or not this is the right year to make an Iber Hashanah, or it doesn't make sense to do it this year. The Gemara tells us there in Sanhedrin Daf Yud Ches, one of the people who's not allowed to be on the committee is the Kohen Gadol. Kohen Gadol is not allowed to be on the committee? I would have said Kohen Gadol is the greatest man in the world. He should certainly be on the committee to decide whether or not it's appropriate to have a Iber Hashanah, whether he should have an extra month this year or not. Says the Gemara, no. Why? Because he might have his own interest in mind. What does he have his own interest in mind? Well, the problem is as follows. He does the Avodah in the Beis HaMikdash on Yom Kippur. Now on Yom Kippur, and in the Beis HaMikdash, one is not allowed to wear shoes. So if Yom Kippur falls out at the time of year when it's still warm outside, so he's going to be fine. He doesn't mind. He's going to walk around barefoot. It's going to be warm. It's not going to be a problem at all. What if Yom Kippur is totally off? What if Yom Kippur ends up being in December one year? Because the calendar is just totally off. And we didn't make an Iber Hashanah, and now he's going to be walking around the Beis HaMikdash. It's going to be freezing cold, because it's going to be December. So what do we do in a case like that? So the Kohen Gadol is going to have his own intention in mind. He's going to say, well, of course we have to make an extra month, because I don't want to be so cold. And he's not going to keep the overall perspective of the Jewish people in mind. He's just going to keep himself in mind, says the Gemara. Even a Kohen Gadol, can you imagine? That's what the Gemara says about a Kohen Gadol. This is what he's thinking about. And therefore he's disqualified from, he's not a neutral party, he's disqualified from being part of this committee for the Iber Hashanah, because we assume he's going to have his own interest in mind. Ask Rabbi Meir Shapiro, what do you mean? If Yom Kippur falls out in December, why don't we just heat up some logs, put a heating system in the Beis HaMikdash, and everything will be fine? What do you mean he's going to have his own interest in mind? We have a way of circumventing his interests. We have a way of figuring out how it's not going to be an issue. Said Rabbi Meir Shapiro, must be that they were not allowed to have a heating system in the Beis HaMikdash. Otherwise, what does this mean? Why should the Kohen Gadol be concerned that maybe he's going to be freezing cold when he does the Avodah on Yom Kippur? Interesting proof. Interesting proof. Thank God we don't agree with him. And basically, on that assumption, he said, well, the same way that applies to a Beis HaMikdash, we extend it also and we say it applies to a Beis HaKnesses as well, because a Beis HaKnesses is Mikdash Miat. So the shul has to have the same rules as the Beis HaMikdash, and the same way you're not allowed to have a heating system in the Beis HaMikdash, you're not allowed to install a heating system in the Beis HaKnesses either. So it's a very surprising assumption, but this is what he writes. And obviously, as I mentioned, we don't paskin like him, but I just thought it was an interesting discussion that the Stechemed gives a lot of attention to. And one last place that I thought was interesting was the Maharal. The Maharal writes in the Siv HaAvoda. We have, surprisingly enough, the Gemara has a concept called Schar Psios. Schar Psios, everyone knows about this. Schar Psios means if you walk far to go somewhere to perform a mitzvah, you get schar for the walking part, for the difficulty. There's a tshuva in the Mahari Steif that Rabbi Finder once showed me. Forgot what his tshuva sefer is called. He's someone pretty contemporary, so he writes about whether or not you fulfill your obligation of Schar Psios if you drive in a car. I don't know. I would assume not, because, what do you mean, how much effort did you put into that? Well, when you have to find a parking spot here, you know, you have a lot of effort that goes in. But anyway, so there's a discussion whether Schar Psios applies nowadays with a car or not. But basically, we have an assumption that there's something called Schar Psios. Do you know how many times in Shas Schar Psios comes up? For those who have been through Shas, only once. Only once. And the whole idea of Schar Psios is only mentioned by a woman. It says that there was a woman who was an almana or something. She didn't have a family. I'm not sure exactly what the Gemara says, but she used to go every day to shul. And on her way to shul, she was able to pass this shul and go in, or she was able to go to the further shul. And she said, you know what, I may as well get Schar Psios, so I'll go to the further shul. So I saw in a sefer recently, Reb Chaim Kanievsky pointed out, Why is it, if Schar P'siyas is such an important idea, why do we only have it by this one case, one almana in the whole Shas, we couldn't find anybody else? What do you think, the Tanaim and the Amoraim didn't also want to get Schar P'siyas? You don't think they walked to the far shul? Why do we only find it by this one almana who walks the shul and decides to walk to the further shul in order to get more reward for the difficulty in her walking? So why do we have it only by her and by nobody else? So he suggested, take it or not, but he suggested that perhaps the reason why is because a man is obligated in Talmud Torah. So every extra minute that you're going to spend walking to shul, who said that that's really right of you to give up of your time to walk to a further shul instead of learning Torah? You should be doing something else. A woman who is not obligated in Talmud Torah, so you know what? She's obligated to daven, so you may as well get more schar for the davening. You may as well walk to the further shul. The Gemara would never say it by a man because it's a waste of the man's time. The man shouldn't be doing that. He should be spending his time doing a different mitzvah. But a woman who's not obligated in Talmud Torah, perhaps she's the reason why the Gemara says it only by a woman and not by a man. To me, that was very very surprising. But again, what happened? You don't like it?
Or if she went to the closest shul, she could daven double. She could get to home.
She, we're assuming that she's davening all along the way, saying to Hillel, come on. Not wasting her time. We all know that. So the Maharal writes, anyway, Schar P'siyas, the Maharal writes, the good news is that until Reb Chaim Kanievsky came around, which was our generation, nobody ever said that. So, you know, you have a few thousand years to rely on that. Maybe he's not correct. I don't know. So, yeah.
Just a quick question while we're talking about differences between men and women. The Oraisa for Kavanas applies to women too?
So again, the whole obligation of women to daven, it's a mitzvah to say Shazman Grama, so women might not be obligated to daven in the first place. But you know, the parts of Karbanos that one should say every day that are very important for one to say are the Parshas HaTamid, which is something which is a collective obligation for men and women. It's a Karban Tzibur that we all offer on behalf of everybody. So I would assume probably should apply both to men and women equally, I would think. So again, the Maharal writes that this idea of Schar P'siyas is an idea that we find, whether it's only by men or if it's by women and men, whatever it is, but he writes as follows. Says the Maharal, V'kach Amr B'Gemara Sota, this is a number Hey on the source sheet. And the Gemara tells us in Masechta Sota, Sheyesh la leches al beis haknesses shehu yoser rachok min ha'adam. A person should choose, if I have a choice to walk to this shul or to the further shul, I should choose to walk to the further shul. Now, this is obviously assuming that everything else is equal. If I'm going to have more kavana in the shul that's closer, obviously you daven in the shul that's closer. But again, if everything is equal, and I have two shuls that are very nice to daven in and a great atmosphere and there's no talking in the shul, so I can either go to this one or I could go to the other one. So I should choose to go to the further one in order that I should gain more schar for the hard difficulty that I had to get there. So then he writes, V'yira, and it seems to me, ki ein hadin hazeh gabi sukkah. Let's say, if I have two sukkahs that I can eat in, and two people invite me over for a meal on sukkahs, I can either go to my next door neighbor or I can go to the person that lives a mile away. Would you say, oh, Schar P'siyas is a great idea. You should really walk a mile in order to fulfill your mitzvah of sukkah, and all the steps that you're going to take along the way are going to are going to add to the experience and to the schar that you're going to get for performing the mitzvah of sukkah. Interesting question, says the Maharal. Shim yesh lo shtei sukkahs ha'achas krova ba'achas rechoka. If I have an option to go to a sukkah which is next door or a sukkah which is a mile away, we would not tell a person to walk to the sukkah a mile away instead of walking to the sukkah in my backyard. We only find this concept of schar p'siyas by a beis hakneses, by walking to a shul. We don't find it by any other concept, by any other mitzvah that we're given in the Torah. Okay, what is the reason, says the Maharal? Why should we assume that that's the case? Ki Hashem Yisbarach Matzi B'Beis HaKnesses. Schar P'siyas is not just that you get more schar for walking to the further way of performing your mitzvah. Well, then it should apply to sukkah also and to every other mitzvah that we perform. Says the Maharal, what it means is, Ki Hashem Yisbarach Matzi B'Beis HaKnesses. The premise is that God's presence is here in the shul. Kimo She'amar Chazal, Ki Beis HaKnesses Hu Mikdash Ma'at. V'lakach, Hashem Yisbarach Matzi B'Beis HaKnesses Hu Lefikach. Again, if a person is in a relationship with somebody else, the more you go out of your way for them, the more they understand how much you love them. If you never go out of your way for the person, it's very difficult to prove to them that you really care about them because you never had to do anything to show it. And that's the same over here. Because a Beis HaKnesses is our way of showing our relationship with God himself, because he resides in the Beis HaKnesses. Therefore, the more you go out of your way to make that relationship with him, the more you show him how much it means to you. Beautiful perspective of what it means, why we have Schar Psius. Why don't we have Schar Sukkah also? Schar Psius to go walk to the further Sukkah, because it's not the same. When you walk into the Sukkah, you're not walking to greet God, you're walking to perform his mitzvah. Over here, when you're walking to the Beis HaKnesses, you're getting yourself ready, you're going out of your way to show God how much you value your relationship with him. And therefore, this idea of Schar Psius is a very important one. V'yadua, ki ha-misno'ea, somebody who walks el ha-daber, who devekus gamar im ha-misno'ea yoser v'zeo devekus v'chibur gamar. He says, as we know, if I go out of my way for my spouse, they are going to understand how much you gave up for them and how much you appreciate and value the relationship, how much you're willing to go out of your way. Therefore, he says, this is what Schar Psius of a Beis HaKnesses is all about as well. And I believe this is also based on the assumption that we assume that a Beis HaKnesses is like a miniature Beis HaMikdash. And because a Beis HaMikdash is our way of having a relationship with God, of visiting his presence, so too a Beis HaKnesses is our way in our times of having that relationship as well. That's why there's this idea of Schar Psius, to show him how much we want to develop, how much we want to invest in the relationship with him. And this is why we have many other aspects of Hilchos Beis HaKnesses, which are patterned and modeled off of the din of Beis HaMikdash. Now, where does the Kedusha of a Beis HaKnesses and a Beis HaMikdash actually come from? So we mentioned this last week, but some people said they weren't clear about what was mentioned. So I'll just say it very briefly again. The Gemara tells us that we have two different categories by mitzvah items. One is, I guess, our shul paskins like Rameir Shapiro, that you're not allowed to have a heating system. So, yeah. Some want to go maybe to the office and ask them if they can. What? Right. You want to? Yeah, something. Just tell them the air is on instead of the heat. So the Gemara says in Megillah, as we mentioned a couple of weeks ago, there are two different categories. There's one category called Tashmishe Mitzvah and another category called Tashmishe Kedusha. Tashmishe Mitzvah, after you're done with them, they can be thrown out. They can be disposed of. For example, we spoke about Neres Chanukah, we spoke about Tzitzis, we spoke about items like that. Or Tashmishe Kedusha, which is a tefillin bag or something of that nature, a cover for a Sefer Torah, we assume that has to be buried after it's finished with its use for the particular tefillin or Sefer Torah. So ask of Soloveitchik, how do you draw the line? How do you know which is in category A? How do you know what's in category B? The answer is, what gives Kedusha in this world is the Torah. That's the only way to have any status and level of Kedusha in our world. And therefore, if you have something which houses the Torah, for example, you have a tefillin bag, because tefillin has Torah written on it, or you have something which covers the Sefer Torah, which we assume is really sanctified, it's holy because it wraps around something which has Ksiva Sefer Torah on it, so we assume something like that, after it's finished with its use, it has to be disposed of in a respectable fashion, it has to be buried. That's the way we have an assumption. However, a mitzvah item, once we're done with it and the mitzvah is over, it doesn't retain any status, any level of Kedusha, and therefore a pair of tzitzis would be able to be disposed of after that is over. This is the idea of the Nefesh HaChaim of Reb Chaim V'Lajner, where he says that all sanctity in the world stems from the Kedusha HaTorah. All sanctity in the world comes from the fact that we have a Torah in this world. This is why the Beis HaMikdash has a elevated status of Kedusha, because we call the Beis HaMikdash the Mishkan HaEdus. That's what the Torah calls it. Why? What is the Edus? Edus is the Luchos, Rashi tells us. So again, the whole sanctity of the Beis HaMikdash revolves around the fact that there's a Luchos in the Beis HaMikdash. If you don't have a Luchos, the Beis HaMikdash doesn't have sanctity either. Because we assume that what sanctifies anything in this world is the fact that there's a Torah. So somebody asked a couple of weeks ago, obvious question, for those who know history, in the Bayis Sheni, they did not have the Luchos. In the Bayis Sheni, the Luchos were not present. So how can you have Kedusha in the Bayis Sheni? What was the relevance? What was the significance of the Bayis Sheni if they never had a Luchos in the whole period of the time that the Bayis Sheni was standing? The answer to that is, what Soloveitchik pointed out, that the Rambam, interestingly enough, the Rambam always quotes just Halacha. All of a sudden over here, the Rambam goes way out of his way and he starts telling you the history. After the Bayis Rishon was destroyed, they went and they hid the Luchos with the Aron underground and they dug it into the ground right underneath the Beis HaMikdash, and then everything was destroyed and they moved on with life, and then they came back 70 years later and they built the second Beis HaMikdash. Now, why does the Rambam tell us the historical fact that they buried the Luchos under the ground? That's a very important point, said Rav Soloveitchik. It's a halachic point, because if you want to know why is it that there was any level of sanctity in the Bayis Sheni, the answer is because the Luchos really were there. Maybe they weren't present, maybe we weren't able to see them, but they were right under the ground. And that's the reason why that place still retained its status of Kedusha. Without knowing that, there would be no reason why the Beis HaMikdash HaSheni should have any Kedusha at all. And this Seder of Soloveitchik is also the reason why Eretz Yisrael has a Kedusha as well. Because as we know, Eretz Yisrael was a place that was conquered via Yehoshua going around Eretz Yisrael with the Aron and the Luchos. Every time the Jewish people went out to battle, they brought the Aron and the Luchos with them. Why? What do you bring the Aron and the Luchos along to battle? They're not going to fight for you. What is that all about? We don't assume that any miraculous bullets come flying out of the Luchos and the Aron, so why do we bring it along? The answer is because if we're trying to be Kovesh Eretz Yisrael, if we're trying to be Mekadesh it, to conquer it, the only way to conquer it and sanctify the land that we conquer is by bringing the Aron and the Luchos with us. And that's the reason why Eretz Yisrael has a Kedusha as well. So again, this is the understanding as to why a Beis HaMikdash has Kedusha, this is why Eretz Yisrael has Kedusha, and this is why we assume that there's a difference, there's a distinction between Tashmishei Kedusha and Tashmishei Mitzvah. We also know that the Gemara tells us every young child is taught when they're in the room, both a man and a woman are taught Kol HaTorah Kula by a Malach, and then before we come out, we forget everything. Now, what is the reason? Why is the Malach teaching us everything and then we forget it? What's the point of that? So Rav Soloveitchik said, perhaps the reason is, again, because that's what gives us, that's what endows us with a Kedusha. If you assume, like the Nefesh HaChaim tells us, that all sanctity in the world only stems from the Kedusha HaTorah, well, what gives sanctity to a Jewish person? What have we done in our lives that gives us any level of sanctity? So you'll say, well, I performed this mitzvah, I did that. Yeah, but once the mitzvah's over, you move on with life. So what sanctity do you have? The answer is no. Because it was ingrained in you, before you were born, it was ingrained in you, Kol HaTorah Kula. And that's the reason why every Jewish person, both a man and a woman, has the retention of Kedusha even after they forget the Torah, but it's Kasva Maluach Libecha, it's written on their heart, and it's something that we never lose. And that's the reason why we have an obligation to bury a Jewish body after the person passes away. Again, because we assume that's like a Sefer Torah. A person is considered like a Sefer Torah, and the same way a Sefer Torah, after it's in disuse, you have to bury it, so too a Jewish person, even after they're in disuse, so to speak, and they no longer can perform mitzvahs, we assume they are like a quasi-Sefer Torah. The Gemara even says, we spoke about Kriya a few weeks ago, just to wrap everything together from the last couple of weeks, but the Gemara says, with regard to Kriya, that at the time of Yetzias Neshama, one has to rip Kriya if they experience the Yetzias Neshama. Why? Because that's like seeing a Sefer Torah Shenisraf. That's like experiencing the Sefer Torah that's being burnt in front of your eyes. And the same way we all know you would have to rip Kriya if, unfortunately, you see something like that happen. So too over here, when there's a loss of life, we assume it's like a Sefer Torah has been lost. Why? What do you mean? What's the connection between a Sefer Torah and a person? Answer is because every person really represents a Sefer Torah because that's something that's been ingrained into us. That's what bestows us with a Kedusha. Yeah. That's a great question. I don't know. I have to ask. Okay. Remind me. Okay, yeah. Got a question? Yeah.
You mentioned before that Salvation said that the Kedusha stems from the Galuto. Mm-hmm. But you also said before that the Kedusha was there even before there was a Beit HaMikdash. Before there was a
Galuto. Uh-huh. Yaakov, so what's the Kedusha at all?
Maybe that's the source for the Kedusha, the second bias.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Not sure, yeah?
I'm still having a problem with the star of Seah.
Okay.
If you get a bigger star making an effort to walk to a Beit Knesset that's farther away,
mm-hmm.
and all of our community, if you make sure that the Beit Knesset is in the center of the community and we build our community around it,
mm-hmm.
should we make an effort to build a Beit Knesset farther away to do it right now?
I don't think it's realistic in our time to assume that if there's a Beis HaKnesses that's all the way in the outskirts of the city, anyone's going to go daven there. Right? I just don't think so. I think everyone will just make breakaway minyanim in their own houses, and that'll be the end of it. Right? So the reason why we do it this way is because, number one, the Gemara tells us in Yuma that you're supposed to have the Beis HaKnesses should be in the center of town, and it should be higher than all other buildings in the town. So the higher part is not so easy, because we have to build houses that are much fancier, so we all have to have higher houses. However, if the shul is able to be in the center of town, that's a very important thing to do, that it should be noticeable, it should be recognizable to everyone that this is the focal point of our lives. The same way in the Beis HaMikdash, in the Mishkan, when they all traveled around in the Midbar, they all encamped, and then they had the Mishkan in the middle. That was the focal point of all of their attention. That's everything that they were doing in the Midbar, was all for the experience of having an enhanced participation of everything that was going on in the Mishkan. So, I think that's the I think that's the reason. But based on what we're saying, I think there's an important point to make as well, and this is something we mentioned, that when we have breakaway minyanim, very often they don't have a Sefer Torah in there. And therefore, if Soloveitchik was of the opinion, it has no status of Kedushas based on Knesset at all. Again, you can daven with a minyan, you can daven with a minyan anywhere. But if you want to have the added level of schus, of davening in a Beis HaKnesses, like the Gemara says, a Beis HaKnesses is a place where God listens to your tefillos more than he listens to them at home. If you want to have that, then you're missing that if you daven in a basement minyan that does not have a Sefer Torah in it. So that's also something to make note of. Yeah, let's make a quick question because we're running out of time. Yeah. The Mishnah Berurah says that? Mishnah Berurah does not say that. The Mishnah Berurah says that if you have a shul, and it's going to look like a bizayon if you're walking by, like you're angry at the shul, oh, you know, everyone knows every day Shechter goes to daven here. All of a sudden he's walking by the shul. Look, he's a batlan, he's not davening today. That's when the Mishnah Berurah says you're not allowed to walk by the shul. It's not the Mishnah Berurah, it's the Gemara in Brachos says it. So it's not his chiddush. That's what the Gemara says in the first parak in Brachos. That a person has to be careful. Even if you want to get to Schar Psias and walk to a further shul, you have to make sure you do it in a way where nobody's going to wonder why you're not going into the shul. But again, if you're the rabbi in the shul, and every day you come to daven in the shul, and all of a sudden today, you're in the middle of walking to shul with your talis and tefillin, and instead you walk right by the shul. Everyone's going to say, oh, what's with him today? How come he got in a fight with somebody? He doesn't want to daven here. He doesn't like the shul anymore. So because of that, we assume that in that case, you shouldn't go to the further shul. But in a regular case, when you have two shuls, Schar Psias, that's what the Gemara says. It does apply. Okay? So now, let's just close with the following thought. Even though we have a similarity between a Beis HaKnesses and a Beis HaMikdash, there is a major difference. Even though there are halachas that connect the two together, but there is a major difference. Let's look at the following. You look at number Vav and number Zayin. The Gemara tells us what are the rules of etiquette for a shul, and what are the rules of proper etiquette for a Beis HaMikdash? So I should have said, if a Beis HaMikdash is a major Beis HaMikdash, and over here is a Mikdash Ma'at, we should have similar rules of etiquette for both. Correct? Why is it that we'll find in a minute that the rules are totally different? The rules are totally different for a Beis HaMikdash and a Beis HaKnesses. Let's look as follows. Says the Gemara, Ezehu Mora, what does it mean to have Mora Mikdash? What does that obligate us to do? Number one, lo yikanes laharabayis bimaklo. You're not allowed to come in with your stick. Now, what exactly does that mean with your stick? What?
I said a baseball bat.
No, I think it means when you have people used to walk with a walking stick. So you're not allowed to bring that into the Beis HaMikdash because we assume it has dirt on it. You're not supposed to bring that in. There's a big discussion in the Acharonim. What if I'm a chassidish rebbe and I walk with a big golden stick? And it's a very fancy thing. It's not something that has dust all over it, so maybe I'm allowed to bring that into the Beis HaMikdash because that's not a violation. And others say, no, even if you're a Hasidus Rebbe, you shouldn't be showing off your Rebbishkeit when you're coming into the shul. So, okay, interesting discussion. We'll worry about it when we become Hasidus Rebbes, I guess. Then the Gemara says you're not allowed to wear your shoes either. Bimin Alo, you have to take your shoes off when you go into the Beis HaMikdash. Ba'ap Pundaso, you're not allowed to wear your belt. Whatever that means. Ba'avaksha ra'aglav. A person has to make sure their feet are cleaned off. Uvamalas hatsurum lo besadino. You're not allowed to bring your wallet in. Velo yasena kapandari. You're not allowed to make it a shortcut. If let's say you have to get from Harazesim to the other side of the old city, you can't just walk through the Makam HaMikdash. You have to go all the way around and not use this as a shortcut. Okay? These are the halachas. That's what governs the behavior in the Beis HaMikdash. Now you come to a Beis HaKnesses, and it should have been something similar. Says the Gemara, not at all. Amar Rava, what is the proper etiquette in a Beis HaKnesses? Ki beso. Here's the determining factor of how a person is supposed to act in a shul. The same way you would act in your own home. Ma beso akapendaria kapit inish. Just like in a person's home, I would not appreciate it if people needed to get from one side of the street to the other and they just walked through my living room in order to get to the other side. I wouldn't like that. Therefore, says the Gemara, you're not allowed, kapandaria means a shortcut. So too, you're not allowed to make a shortcut out of the shul. So again, to make a shortcut out of the lobby of the shul that doesn't have a kedusha. But to make a shortcut out of a shul itself and walk from one end to the other just because you need to get to the other side of the street, the Gemara says that is not appropriate. Arakika umino lo kapadinshi. In my home, I don't mind if people wear shoes. And the Gemara says, in my home, I don't mind if people spit on the floor, back in the times when they had a dirt floor. So if someone had saliva, they would spit on the floor, they kicked it into the ground. Nobody minded. So the Gemara says, therefore in a shul, we'll talk about that in a minute, therefore in a shul we assume you are allowed to spit on the floor, you're allowed to wear shoes, but you are not allowed to make it a shortcut because that's something I would not want to do in my own home. Said of Soloveitchik, why should this be the case? Why should there be any difference between a Beis HaKnesses and a Beis HaMikdash? If in fact they both have a very similar status of a Mikdash or a Mikdash Ma'at, shouldn't they be the same? So Rav Soloveitchik suggested as follows. He said, when you go to the experience of having a Beis HaMikdash, that's an experience of visiting God in His palace. What does it say? Ki Beisi Beis Tfila Yikari L'chal Ha'amim. My home, God says. Beisi Beis Tfila is a reference to the Beis HaMikdash. My home, says God, is a Beis Tfila Yikari L'chal Ha'amim, is there for everybody to come and feel connected and feel a relationship with me. It's God's home. When you go visit the Makam HaMikdash, you're visiting God's home. Shivti b'veis Hashem, kol yemei chayei. This is what David HaMelech asked for. I want to sit in the house of God, in the Beis HaMikdash, kol yemei chayei. That's what I want. When we come to a Beis HaKnesses, we assume this is the Beis HaMshel HaTzibur. This is our home. And we invite God into our home to visit us. It's a very different experience. When we're visiting the Beis HaMikdash, we're going to visit Him in His palace. When we're davening in a shul, we get together, and because there's a people that are gathering together to daven to Hashem, He comes to visit us in our home. This is what the Gemara says. This is why it's only called a Mikdash Ma'at. It's not God's palace. A shul is not God's palace. It's only a Mikdash Ma'at because really it's our home. It happens to be that God comes to visit our home. That's what happens when we get together to daven. That's what the Gemara says in Brachos Davavam and Beis. Kivin she, if we call davening for 9 o'clock and God comes to shul at 9, He's on time, and He sees that there aren't people there yet that are ready to daven, miyad kois, He gets angry. And the pasuk that's quoted there in the Gemara is, madu abasi ve'ein ish. How come I have come to visit you and nobody's here yet? How come I have come to visit you and nobody's here yet? What does that indicate? That God is coming to visit us. That's what Rav Soloveitchik pointed out. Madu abasi ve'ein ish means the Beis HaKnesses is our home. And because it's our home, it's God's obligation to come and spend the time with us. And therefore, he said, this is the reason why we find a major difference between the conduct that we're supposed to have in a Beis HaMikdash and the etiquette and the conduct that we're supposed to have in a Beis HaKnesses. In a Beis HaMikdash, we follow the rules of going to God's palace. That's why we have a whole bunch of rules. What's the determining factor for the proper behavior in a shul, says the Gemara? Ki beiso. The way you would act in your own home. You know why? Because this is our home. This is not God's home. This is our home, and God comes to visit us in our home. And that's why the way we would act in our home is the way we are supposed to determine our behavior for a shul as well. Therefore, says the Gemara, you're not allowed to make the shul as a shortcut because you wouldn't like it, you wouldn't appreciate it if people used your home as a shortcut. And therefore, if Soloveitchik pointed out as well, even though the Gemara says spitting on the floor, nowadays when we have nice carpets and nice floors and nobody would ever spit on the floor in my house, well, so too in a shul, you're not allowed to spit on the floor either. Rav Soloveitchik took it further and he said, if somebody was wearing snowy boots into my house, I would ask them to please take it off by the door and change. Well, so too in a shul, he said. Ki beiso determines that I'm not allowed to walk into a shul with my boots that have snow on them. I would never allow people to walk through my house and destroy the carpets. I would never allow someone to walk through my house and get everything all wet if they have, you know, if they have rain all over their shoes or whatever it is. I would ask them to please wipe off their feet before they came in, and then they would come into the house and walk around. Said Rav Soloveitchik, that's the same principle that applies to a shul nowadays. We have to think about what's the etiquette that we would have, what's the conduct we would have in our own shuls, in our own homes, and that's the way we're supposed to act in a shul as well. Rav Soloveitchik said, I don't know how relevant it is for women, but for men, this is a major problem. You have men, can't sit still during davening. You ever look down in the men's section? Everyone's walking around. Are you walking here? Are you walking there? And I always wonder, like, where are they going? Do they think God's more over here? Do they think He's more over there? It's a very strange kind of thing. Would you ever walk into a church? I've never been, but I would imagine nobody prays to whoever they're praying to like this and looking around and walking and fidgeting. It just doesn't make sense. So Rav Chaim Soloveitchik pointed out that it's also, you wouldn't like it if people came to your house and started just walking around your living room and checking everything out and walking and taking a book over here and a book over there. So he said that's the same of ki beiso. That's not the proper behavior for somebody's house, and therefore it's not the proper behavior for a shul either to walk around. Rav Chaim pointed out that the Mishnah says, Asara Nisim, there were 10 miracles that happened in the Beis HaMikdash. 10 very obvious miracles. Obviously there were more, but 10 very obvious ones. One was, Omdim tzvufim u'mishtachavim rivachim, which means when everybody came to visit the Beis HaMikdash on Yom Kippur, it was millions of people there, and they were standing like sardines. There was no room to move. Mishtachavim rivachim. But all of a sudden, when it came time to bow down on the floor, plenty of room. Everyone was able to extend themselves all the way out, and there was no problem at all. So Reb Chaim said, the truth is, the miracle was not the omdim tzvufim. The miracle was not that they stood like sardines. The miracle was that there was room to bow down. So why does the Mishnah say one of the miracles was that they stood like sardines and then there was room to bow down? So Rav Chaim said, no, the first part is also a miracle. The fact that everyone stood in their place, also a miracle. That everyone stood in their place and didn't walk around all over, that's also a miracle because it never happens. So that's what Rav Chaim suggested, obviously a little bit of a joke. But that's basically the major difference between Shabbos and between Beis HaMikdash and Beis HaKnesses. And I think if you take it a little bit farther, this is really the difference between the experience of Shabbos and the experience of Yom Tov. Shabbos is the time, if you'll notice, we only have Kabbalah Shabbos. We don't have such a thing as Kabbalah Yom Tov. Why? Anyone ever think about it? Why don't we say Kabbalah Yom Tov before Yom Tov comes in? Doesn't Yom Tov come to visit us also? And Yom Tov? So that's the difference, that Shabbos is the experience of God coming to spend the time with us in our homes. This is why we have Kabbalah Shabbos. Yom Tov is our experience, it's supposed to be, in its most pristine sense, it's supposed to be, we have an experience to go lefnei Hashem, to go visit Him in His palace. We only have a mitzvah of Aliyah L'Regel on the Yomim Tovim. We don't have a mitzvah of Aliyah L'Regel every Shabbos, because every Shabbos God comes to visit us in our homes, which is a very humbling thing to think about. God's actually coming to your house every Shabbos, are you really ready for that? Are you really prepared for that? Reb Shimshon Pinkus writes a beautiful mashal in his sefer. He says, you know, that there were parents who traveled once from South Africa to visit their kids in, let's say, New Yerushalayim, I'm not sure exactly, but he says that they made up, they were planning for weeks and weeks that they're going to book this ticket and they're going to come to visit all the grandchildren and everything, and they told them exactly when they're going to land. Now, I don't know how long the flight is, but let's say it's 15 hours, and these were elderly parents, and it was a big deal for them to come visit their grandchildren in Yerushalayim. And they get to the airport and they don't even have a cell phone and they're looking around to see, is anybody here from our family? They don't see. And there's obviously nobody standing by the exit of the airport with a sign for them. So they ask somebody, like they're a little embarrassed, but they turn to someone and they say, can we borrow your cell phone? We want to call our grandchildren. We just traveled all the way. They borrow a cell phone. They're all embarrassed that they're borrowing from someone. And they call the family and the son says, oh, yeah, I forgot all about it. I can't believe you're coming. And he's beside himself. He says, you know what, just jump in a taxi, come straight to the house. And we'll see you soon. So they get in a taxi. They're a little bit offended that, you know, how did the kid forget? We've been preparing this trip for so long, and all of a sudden we're here, and he forgets about it. He doesn't remember to pick us up. So they get to the house, and they're looking which one is the right number, and there's nobody waiting outside, and they're all upset. I don't understand. We're on his block. He can't even wait outside for us. We just called him that we're going to be here in a half an hour. And finally they find the house, and they knock on the door, and nobody answers. They ring the bell. Nobody answers. Somebody says on the intercom, we're all busy right now. You know, just come inside. Go to the powder room. We'll be right out. What kind of way is that to treat your grandparents who come all the way from South Africa, take the long trip, told you they're going to be here, and this is the way you treat them, this is what you do to them? And this is the experience, says of Shimshon Pinkus, that so often we have on a Friday afternoon, that we don't understand. When we're not prepared, let's say, for Pesach, okay, so Pesach either is going to happen or it won't happen, but it's not that Pesach is offended. When you're not prepared for a Shabbos, it's like your parents just came from South Africa. It's God coming to visit your house and you're not ready for Him? How embarrassing that is to Shabbos. How embarrassing that is to your family member that they're taking the effort to go all the way out of their way to come and visit you, and this is the way you treat them. You don't pick them up from the airport. You forget all about it. You don't even have the decency to come outside and wait for them on the street. You don't have the decency to open the door for them. You send the maid out to open the door instead of you. So that's the experience, says of Shimshon Pinkus, of what every Friday afternoon is supposed to feel like. We're supposed to feel as if our family member is coming from a far distance. This is why we have a Kabbalah Shabbos. Because we're ushering Shabbos into our homes, into our lives. We're welcoming that relationship. Come spend the next 25 hours with us and understand what does it look like in our homes. Understand when we sit at a Shabbos table, what does it mean to have God sitting around our table? It's not such a simple feat. It's very humbling. What does it mean that God's going to be in the presence of our home for the experience of the entire Shabbos every single week? That's the difference between Shabbos and Yom Tov. That's the difference between Beis HaKnesses and Beis HaMikdash. And this is basically why the laws that govern the conduct in a Beis HaKnesses are very different than the laws that govern our behavior in a Beis HaMikdash. Again, because a Beis HaMikdash is considered Armono Shel HaMelech, it's considered the palace of God Himself. That obligates us to act in a certain way. When we come to a Beis HaKnesses, that's considered the Beis Ham Shel HaTzibur. And since it's our home, that's what the Gemara says, the conduct is determined based on the way we would act in our own private homes. We find by Bilam HaRasha, and with this we'll close, the Gemara tells us by Bilam, he was asked to curse the Jewish people, and instead, he says, Matovu Ahalecha Yaakov Mishkanosecha Yisrael. Says Rashi, you see, from Berchaso, Mahayor Kilhalaso, you see, from the fact that he ended up giving a bracha, Matovu Ahalecha Yaakov, how beautiful are your shuls, are your batik nesios, you see what he wanted to curse them. So what was the curse supposed to be? How awful are your shuls? They should all be destroyed. So Rav Asher Weiss once pointed out to me, you hire someone to curse the Jewish people that they should be destroyed. So if you had to think, what exactly would you formulate in such a curse? What would you say? You would come up with some real significant curse of how you're going to destroy the Jewish people. You should all be hit by a holocaust, by this, by that, whatever it is, and everyone should be destroyed. That's what Bilam should have said. What does he say? You should destroy the shuls. And what you see clearly from this is, without shuls, without having this opportunity of reconnecting ourselves to the Ribbono Shel Olam, of having that ongoing relationship with Him, we wouldn't be a people. That's exactly what Bilam set out to do. Destroy the shuls. He knew the secret. If you destroy their shuls, they are not a people. And they will not exist. They won't last because they don't have God in their lives. If they don't have God in their lives, there's no reason for them to live. This is what we learn from Bilam. That's the significance of a Beis HaKnesses. That's what it's supposed to mean to all of us. And that's something to think about when we come to a Beis HaKnesses and we have, you know, people getting upset, why are people talking during davening and this and that. Just think about the fact that a Beis HaKnesses is a place which is a Mikdash Ma'at. It's a place which is designated as our communal place of welcoming God into our lives. And you're going to sit there and talk? And you're going to sit there and walk around and wear your dirty boots into the shul and spit on the floors and do all sorts of things and use it as a shortcut? Is that a way to treat God when He comes to visit us in our homes? And when we think about the experience of Shabbos, it's the same thing. What is God going to feel like when He leaves our home after, so to speak, going out of His way to come and visit us? What does He feel like? How have we treated Him? Have we invested in that relationship and made sure that He feels welcome, that He wants to come back again, so to speak? That He's going to know that we care enough to have that ongoing relationship with Him? So when we talk about Beis HaMikdash and we talk about the Kotel and the experience of having all of that, it's an opportunity for us to remind ourselves that we don't always have to go to Yerushalayim to have that relationship with God. We can have the relationship with Him here as well, but it also obligates us to act in a certain way and to make sure we live up to a standard in which God is comfortable coming to visit our homes as well.